Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The federal government just released new data on payments from pharmaceutical companies to doctors for speeches, meals, and research. The value of those transactions totaled nearly $3.5 billion in the five-month period from August through December 2013. That's according to the U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. The investigative journalism website ProPublica has been independently documenting these payments in a project called Dollars for Docs. We're joined now by a senior reporter for ProPublica, Charles Ornstein. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me.
What are drug companies paying the doctors for? What are they getting for their money?
So drug and medical device companies for many years, in fact, probably for decades, have paid doctors for a whole lot of different things. So they pay them to be consultants, to help them come up with new research avenues and also better approaches to market their drugs. They pay them to be promotional speakers for their drugs. And then they pay them for things like meals or educational items. They pay for travel. There's a whole variety of different things. And the goal is, I think, to build relationships with the physicians and also to promote their drugs so that they are actually used.
And what should the consumers be aware of in terms of those transactions?
So researchers have concerns that these transactions, while in many cases they may be appropriate, they also have the potential to influence a doctor's perception about a particular drug or device, or perhaps to even make a doctor more likely to prescribe a drug or device when something that is an alternative, like changes to lifestyle, may be more appropriate to begin with.
How have you gotten access to the information about drug company and medical technology companies' payments to doctors?
So we began our Dollars for Docs website, which people can find at ProPublica.org, by looking at the payment reports released by pharmaceutical companies after they settled whistleblower lawsuits. So those are lawsuits filed by former employees that allege that they gave either kickbacks to doctors or that they improperly marketed their drugs. And so these companies settled the suits, paid hundreds of millions, in some cases billions of dollars to the government, and also agreed to release the names of the doctors that they had financial relationships with.
Are your numbers going to differ from what the government came up with?
Absolutely. So for 2013, we have payment records for 17 companies, and we have about 1.2 million payment records worth about $1.4 billion. But our, like I said, our site only includes 17 companies. The federal site includes about 1,000 companies. And the federal site also only has information for the last 5 months of 2013, whereas our site for the companies we provide include information for the whole year 2013.
So what, how much, what are doctors doing? Are they, there's, why are they revealing? Is the money that the government, is the data that the government's using coming from the companies or is it coming from the doctors?
That's a great question. This is coming from the companies. And in some cases, doctors probably don't even know that this is being released. I mean, there's been an attempt by the government to educate doctors that this is coming and to give them an opportunity to review their data in advance and contest it if they see a problem. But a very small fraction of doctors actually did that. Fewer than 5% of doctors looked at their payments before they were made public. I think the real question is, you know, what should patients do with this? And I think, you know, the answer is some patients care a lot about this and some patients don't care at all about this. And I think either approach is fine. If you do care about this, the federal website is really not consumer-friendly at all right now. And I would not recommend it to consumers to use until they make some pretty significant additions. I think people will spin their wheels and spend hours and not find what they're looking for. So for now, I'd encourage people to go to our site if this is a topic they're interested in. Look up their physicians, and then for each payment record, we have a link to a checklist that you can print out and bring to your doctor, which includes some questions you can ask, as well as links to impartial information about a drug. So you can see what the side effects are, you can see what the drug's intended uses are, and that can help you be a more educated consumer.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Charles Ornstein. He's a senior reporter for ProPublica. We're talking about the issue of drug companies, medical technology companies, paying doctors for speeches, for research, providing meals and other perks for supporting their work, for doing, you know, like I said, for speeches and so forth, for being spokespersons for their products. If you have a question or comment for Charlie Orenstein, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So a typical doctor, is there any sense of typical in all of this?
Not really. I think that, I guess if you were to say that there is something like typical, it's a doctor who receives a meal or two from pharmaceutical companies. It's pretty common for doctors to get a meal either at the office or to attend an evening program and to get a meal. What's atypical are the number of doctors who, say, have a relationship with a company in which they receive royalty payments for a product or where they are paid speakers. So while those receive a lot of money, they're relatively few and far between. So all told, there are more than 500,000 doctors who had information released on them yesterday. But the vast majority of them only receive meals. A much, much, much smaller percent, probably far less than 10%, had a different type of relationship.
Right. Most of them receive meals, but meals actually take up a very small percentage of the overall total.
That's right. Yeah. So meals, you know, account for something like more than 3 billion of the 4 billion payments. But they only, you know, really represent less than 10% of the overall spending in just the general category, which is even smaller overall. So they represent about $92 million in spending out of $4 billion, but they account for more than more than 3 million of the 4 million transactions. So you see a big disconnect there.
Why is the government's doing this? It was passed in the law along with the Affordable Care Act, right?
Right. So when you think of the Affordable Care Act, you think of health insurance exchanges, you think of Medicaid and the big debates over whether to expand Medicaid or not. But tucked in there are a number of other things, and this is one of them. The reason this was passed is because two senators, Charles Grassley of Iowa and a retired senator, Herb Kohl of Wisconsin, had concerns about doctors having relationships with pharmaceutical companies and not disclosing those relationships either in medical journal articles or to their patients, and they felt that patients had a right to know. And so they weren't saying that doctors shouldn't take the payments, but they did say that patients should be able to know about them. So this all sort of arose out of that effort to make patients better informed about these type of transactions involving their doctors.
And so far, there hasn't been much response from physicians to this.
I think the physician community, particularly the American Medical Association, is concerned about the accuracy of this data.
Mm-hmm.
Look, this is a new, first, out-of-the-box effort, and there's going to be errors. I mean, one of the things we found yesterday, we were looking at different drug names that companies were reporting, and there was one that was just called knees. Well, there's not a drug named knees. There's another called, you know, foot and ankle. Well, there's not a drug called foot and ankle either. So you know, there's lots of errors in here. That's going to take some time to correct. And I think the concern is before you start attributing things to individual doctors by name and have the potential for patients to be making medical decisions based on this, like, let's make sure it's right.
What if I wanted to look up a drug that my doctor is pushing? Could I look up that company and see how much money they've spent promoting that drug to doctors?
It would be enormously difficult using this federal website to do that.
Yeah.
If they were in our Dollars for Docs database, you could do that pretty easily.
Okay.
But I mean, I just think that at the moment, the status quo, the current state of play of the federal database is it's really not at all consumer friendly. And until they fix that, I would try to avoid it.
To what extent do we know that drug companies depend on these kinds of expenditures to get the news out to doctors? How does that work?
Well, I mean, look, drug companies are fiduciaries, so mm-hmm. they have to look out for their shareholders in addition to their public missions, but their first priority is to their shareholders, and they're not going to be spending a lot of money on something that doesn't work. That would be a waste, and they would be sort of that's not a good thing. So this is clearly working in getting out a message about their products.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also true that doctors are busy. They don't have time to read all the medical journal articles that are out there and to stay up on all the developments. And so there is a role to play for pharmaceutical companies into helping get information in the hands of doctors. I think the question is, what is the right balance and where does it cross a line? And, you know, how much of this should patients know about? And that's the stage we're at now, is that I think that there's been a societal decision that, you know, the era of keeping this behind closed doors is over, and the era of making this public is here. But now I think the focus has to be, how do you make this information in a language that people speak and that they can understand? It's not there yet.
Dave in Columbus, you're on the air with Charles Ornstein of ProPublica. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You
listen,
bet.
After hearing your guest's last remarks, I really don't have much to add. I think the practice of reps bringing meals into physician offices is largely benign. These guys are busy. I happen to, full disclosure, my sister-in-law is a rep for a pharmaceutical company,
mm-hmm.
and I myself have worked in pharmaceutical marketing in the past. I can tell you that most of the time, it's really just a time issue for the physician. If you want to, and by the way, most of the interactions are usually 10 minutes or less.
Mm-hmm.
That's how busy these guys are. And the meals typically go to feed staff and
right.
occasionally patients.
Okay, well, it's a small number then that are getting the big bucks. Dave, thanks a lot for your call. We appreciate it.
I think the concern to Dave's point, though,
mm-hmm.
That folks raise is that even small gifts, as small as a pen, which are now banned, you know, by drug companies, they can't give them out to doctors anymore. But even a meal, that it does influence behavior, and that surveys have shown that physicians who receive meals think differently about drugs and drug companies than those who don't take them. That's why I think you see a lot of prominent academic medical centers that now prohibit sales representatives from visiting their doctor's offices and bringing meals, is they want to take that out of the equation. They don't want that to even play a factor in what a doctor selects. So while every doctor will tell you they don't base their decisions based on that, I think there's some evidence to suggest that it does at least influence perceptions.
We have an email from John who writes, please, as this conversation goes forward, we should consider using the word healthcare providers. This is not a conversation about just doctors. Nurse practitioners are courted by drug companies and do as much, if not more, prescribing. I think that's a good point.
Actually, we are talking about doctors. This law does not cover nurse practitioners or physician assistants. It covers medical doctors, osteopaths, chiropractors, podiatrists, optometrists, but it does not cover those other two. And what we found in analyzing a very first pass of the data is that about 69% of the payments are being given to medical doctors, MDs.
Mm-hmm.
About 25% of the payments are going to teaching hospitals. That leaves 6%. So the rest of that 6% is going to, you know, the chiropractors, dentists, optometrists, podiatrists, and others that are in this, but there's not nurses in this.
But eventually, do you see nurse practitioners as they have a growing role in the business?
Nurse practitioners absolutely play a huge role in care mm-hmm. of patients and in prescribing drugs. And I think it is an oversight to not include them in this. And I think pharmaceutical companies, as they look for how to adapt their business strategies going forward, may indeed turn to nurse practitioners, knowing that these type of payments won't have to be disclosed for them.
Well, Charles Ornstein, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about it. I'm sure it's an ongoing conversation, and hopefully we'll chat again.
Hey, Anne, thanks so much for having me.
Charles Ornstein, he's a senior reporter for ProPublica. Once again, the website for that, if you want to go to ProPublica, is ProPublica.org/docdollars. We'll have that website the link to that website on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Well, Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Humans have been conceiving, giving birth to, and feeding other humans for about 200,000 years. But technology is changing the events that lead up to and surround the modern pregnancy. As more advanced, complicated, and expensive fertility treatments come to the fore, some women are returning to traditional methods. Joining us now is ethnobotanist, herbalist, and owner and founder of Mockingbird Meadows and its Eclectic Herbal Institute, and the author of a new book on the topic, Conceiving Healthy Babies, Dawn Combs. Welcome back, Dawn.
Thank you, Anne, for having me.
At the beginning of the book, you caution your readers to consult with a physician. Mm-hmm. Did you feel compelled to do this, or tell us about just first of all about that part of the equation?
I think, unfortunately, in the natural realm right now, we have a polarization between Western medicine and the holistic medicine, if you will, that doesn't need to be there. I think we can absolutely choose technologies from Western medicine and use them appropriately at the same time as do things that promote daily wellness. And so I think people should have somebody from the medical profession on their healthcare team. I just believe that we need to go back to making those decisions on our own and having lots of healthcare consultants.
There was another thing I read in your book, which was a part of, I think, the introduction by your husband, mm-hmm. who wrote about your passion for this and how this is something that has impassioned you from the beginning, long before you met him. And, you know, it really is part of a pattern in your life. Not everybody has the proclivity to understand the literature and the knowledge that's out there or the time or any of that kind of a thing. And I imagine that's what Conceiving Healthy Babies, an herbal guide to support preconception, pregnancy, and lactation in your new book is for people who don't necessarily have the time themselves. But what about people who feel like, well, yeah, I think it's really cool what Dawn Combs is doing, but I feel better going to a hospital and doing it what we now consider the traditional or old-fashioned way.
Yeah, I think there's room for all of that. I think we need to support women in whatever their choice was. I personally was going to do the opposite, going into a hospital. I was going to shut down, freak out. I was not that, ooh, boy, now everything's okay person. And mm-hmm. lots of women are, and there's nothing wrong with that. We have to stop vilifying different women's choices. Mm-hmm. But I do believe, regardless of where a woman chooses to give birth and how and with what support, we need to change the preconception conversation in this country. We need to start thinking about having our bodies, both male and female, parts of the partner, completely solid, completely healthy before we begin to build a new person.
So you're an ethnobotanist and an herbalist. Tell me first what an ethnobotanist is.
Ethnobotany is really the study of how humans use plants.
Okay.
It's really broad. So ethnobotany can look at how we use plants to dye our clothes, to make our clothes, the fibers we use. I specifically, as an ethnobotanist, focus on how humans use plants as medicine. And I'm concerned with the phytochemicals that we find and the nutritional aspects that we find within those plants, the stories we tell, how we pass down that knowledge, those sorts of things.
You write in the book that you had a life plan as far as marriage and children go, and you just expected that. But for you, it didn't necessarily work out as you expected.
I was like a lot of other women right now. We have an epidemic of fertility issues. You see it before the first pregnancy. You see it after a first pregnancy, after somebody has actually had a baby. A lot of people are having a lot of hormonal imbalances that our only option seems to be, or it was for me, to go to the fertility industry. And I believe that they only address a certain type of fertility issue. And then we have this large pool of people that aren't being addressed. I think we can address that with food, lifestyle, and with herbs.
So you write about the connection between proper nutrition and fertility. So what do we know about that?
Well, unfortunately, our standard American diet kind of deselects for the human population right now. We aren't eating food. We're eating food-like substances, and we weren't designed to evolutionarily, we weren't designed to feel like we could add on anything when the system is stressed. We're designed to be completely healthy and then add something new, add on top of that, but we can't do that because we aren't being fully nourished. Things like proper fats and vegetables, of course, your vegetables and fruits, but things that are even deeper than that, properly preparing our grains, eating the right kinds of meat, eating the right kind of vitamins and minerals that most traditional cultures knew we needed to really, really beef up the richness and the land of milk and honey for the body before we were doing things for fertility.
This is Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Dawn Combs. She's an ethnobotanist and herbalist at Mockingbird Meadows Farm. I've had her on the show before that to talk about a lot of her work with Mockingbird Meadows. But today, it's to talk about her new book. It's called Conceiving Healthy Babies, an herbal guide to support preconception, pregnancy, and lactation. If you have a question or comment for Dawn, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. More than half of the book is a glossary of different herbs that can play a role in conception, pregnancy, and lactation. So what should we know before taking an herbal approach? How does one a start with this kind of a process?
Well, the big impetus behind me writing that herbal was that when I went to have a child, I was seeing doctors that would hand me a 3-page, single-spaced, front-back list of books I shouldn't even breathe near. And some of those apply to a lot of women. Some of them only apply in certain conditions. So I felt like there was a lack of, why shouldn't I use golden seal? Why can't I use chamomile? And I'm a real big person that you can't make a good decision unless you have all the information. So my herbal puts out all the things that are contraindicated in preconception, pregnancy, and lactation, but it explains how they might be used and why they might not be a good choice so that you can make that decision, whether that applies to you. You can go to your healthcare team and say, okay, this says only if I have a liver problem. I don't have a liver problem, right? Do I really need to worry about this herb? We need that information out there, and it just wasn't anywhere.
Do you recommend that women self-treat with herbs, or do you think it's something that they should be talking about with a specialist?
It depends. There are a lot of things that are tonic in nature that a book like mine can give you a good safety factor and understanding. Chamomile, okay, here's the contraindication. I don't have that problem. We have a long history of safe chamomile use. I don't think there's going to be a problem with me using chamomile. Something like a golden seal, it's a little more targeted. It's mm-hmm. certainly safe, but in some cases not. So that may take a little bit more consulting. Look at a book. Talk to an herbalist. Talk to your doctor. And then there are absolutely some that I think of mistletoe or pokeweed. They can be toxic if they're not handled correctly, and in the hands of a common knowledge person, shouldn't be used. Should be used only with a knowledgeable herbalist or healthcare practitioner.
Are herbs, when you use them for these kinds of reasons and conditions, are they something that you need to measure it out? It's the same sort of thing as with any kind of prescription. The amounts, maybe toxicity is not the right word, but the strength can vary from plant to plant and that kind of a thing.
I think
you need to be concerned with.
Yeah, it's a combination of having some basic knowledge, which we all used to have. I call it our herbal birthright. We've kind of lost the ability to know how much and how often and whether I can go out in the backyard and pick yarrow and use it. Getting that back in, which is something I'm very passionate about, everybody owning themselves. But beyond that, once you understand how to quote unquote dose, which we don't really dose with herbs, it's really better to use them as food. But they can create a level of too much, just like anything else. If you over ingest something, even a healthy food can be a problem.
And I imagine when you're deciding whether or not to use something, it depends on what your condition is at the time.
Mm-hmm.
For example, when you're pregnant, you have a lot of morning sickness and a lot of nausea. You're going to maybe consider some remedies. But if you don't have it, you don't necessarily need to worry about it then.
Some of the hard work of using a natural modality is knowing your own body and having the confidence of knowing your own body. And that takes time. And that's the only way you're going to know whether this is appropriate for me or not. And sometimes taking a little bit, you could ingest peppermint, which is pretty innocuous, And maybe it doesn't work with your body chemistry. And if you know yourself and you know, whoa, that's not a normal, you know, I just broke out in hives or my stomach didn't feel good. That level of listening to your body, listening to your inner voice is something that we really need to learn to tap back into.
With lactation, with breastfeeding, we're always told what we shouldn't eat mm-hmm. and drink, alcohol, number one. But can you give us some general suggestions for people? I know a lot of people who struggle with breastfeeding. That's been a big problem.
Oh, yeah. Again, it goes back to in the book, I go through my struggles with infertility that I overcame. I go on to have lactation issues in the book, and that's a lot because we aren't addressing the hormonal imbalances before pregnancy. Those same hormonal imbalances will cause difficulty in lactation. There are foods and there are herbs that can help to support optimally, but if you aren't still working, if you aren't balanced within your body, you're not able to produce an optimal amount of milk.
Are there recommendations for actual labor and how you should prepare your body for labor with what you eat? You know, everyone, there's always the jokes about have sauerkraut and a sausage the night before, you know, go into labor and that kind of thing. But beyond that,
there are a lot of old wives' tales
right.
and those kinds of the fun things. And if you look through any old wives' tale, you can always follow back and see some sort of grain of truth. But yes, there are absolutely things you can do for optimal birth. Ironically, one of the herbs that we see limited and recommended, contraindicated against in Western medicine is raspberry leaf. And raspberry leaf is a really important tonic all the way through pregnancy. And I did ice chips of raspberry leaf tea during my labor.
You mean you can use the leaves too?
It's the leaf, yeah. It's high in a phytochemical called fragrine, and it's also filled with vitamins and minerals, but it tends to be highly astringent, and it is able to tone the muscle action of our uterus. And
how do you know that?
Well, the great thing about advancements in being able to study herbs is we have written history from forever, and we can look back at that. We can also now look at clinical studies that are being done, peer-reviewed clinical studies that are this similar to the Western medicine studies that are being done. We can look at the actions of the chemicals themselves from a botanical standpoint to really get a strong understanding of what that plant is doing within the body. Even with knowing all of that, it's still not a guarantee. You still have to know your own body. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of things that we can draw on now, which I think is part of the problem. I think people get out there on the internet and there's so much information that it's really difficult to wade through. The science can be really difficult to understand, and the common things that are being published sound like a used car salesman about how an herb is going to fix everything under the sun. And unfortunately, if it sounds too good to be true, it really is. Herbs are amazing. They can do a lot for us, but it takes a lot of work on the part of the person that's actually using them.
Yeah, and it's usually something most people only go through once or twice in their life, or maybe more, but pregnancy is not something you do on a regular basis.
Yeah, yeah.
For most of us.
It's so important. I think we are getting more and more degenerative disease in our society, and I believe strongly that if we don't start thinking about how we condition our bodies to give birth, if that is something that you choose to contribute to society, we need to do it right. We need to be having fully nutrient-dense children.
Have you heard from physicians about your book?
Yes, I have a couple of physicians that have looked at the book and given me endorsements. I think in the medical community, I'm sure I'll have lots of people that disagree with me. That won't surprise me at all. But I don't think we will have a lot of disagreement with the idea that we need to start addressing our health problems first before we're having babies, because those health problems, those deficiencies in our body, that's where the baby is created. It's the soil. And so we're passing on those deficiencies. I don't think anybody's going to disagree with trying to have the healthiest babies that we can.
Well, Dawn Combs, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Dawn Combs, she's an ethnobotanist and herbalist at Mockingbird Meadows Farm. She's also the author of a new book. It's called Conceiving Healthy Babies, an herbal guide to support preconception, pregnancy, and lactation. Wellness Wednesday continues. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. While one-third of American adults are obese, millions more struggle with just those last 5 pounds. Some people refer to it as the vanity weight, the pounds that separate us from our skinny jeans, whatever those are. And while it could be due to a lack of commitment or too much snacking, there are real biological reasons that it's so hard to lose that last bit of weight. Joining us now to discuss this and other fitness topics is a fitness trainer and freelance writer, Gabriella Boston. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So why is it so much easier to lose the first 10 pounds than the last 10 pounds?
Well, it's a combination of things. A lot of the time when we lose those first pounds, it can be lots of water weight that goes first. And secondly, the body has kind of a set point, not one that's determined throughout life, but one where we get comfortable. So in other words, a weight that we keep for a long time is something that the body tends to defend.
Doesn't necessarily mean that it's in defending an ideal weight.
Exactly. It doesn't have to be an ideal weight. It's just a weight that you've had for a while. So, in other words, you might have been 100 and, this is just an example, 120 pounds for years, but then for some reason you started working out less and you fell off the wagon with your diet, and then suddenly that set weight became 130 pounds. So then that's what the body gets used to.
Is it sort of like your body's addiction to a certain weight and it takes a certain amount of time to overcome that, or is it something more complicated?
It may just be a matter of getting back to good habits. It may be just a matter of getting back to one of the things that I find incredibly challenging, but something that a lot of clients benefit from is keeping a food log. It could be that you've just gotten sloppy over time. But again, it's individual. For some people, it's a combination of that in addition to, you know, paying attention to why and when we eat. Are we bored or are we actually hungry?
Do you recommend setting an ideal weight or a dream weight as a goal? Are there better indicators? What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, we have charts, the BMI charts that tell us what, you know, what normal, average, and what's called, you know, healthy weight is, and what's below it and what's above it. And so I think for health purposes, that's what we should keep in mind, is that BMI weight. Now, of course, the vanity weight, if that's something that encourages us because we feel like, well, I want to look good in a swimsuit and so forth, we should also keep in mind that that is probably at the lower end of what that healthy weight is, and it's going to be challenging to get there.
One thing that might be sabotaging some of us is well-intentioned snacking. You wrote recently about labels like organic and vegan. Should we not be looking for those labels at the store? What should we think about when we think about snacking?
Well, I think this is one of those where it's been beaten into us lately. I think the idea of it's not only those labels that are important, but also looking at whole foods. So I'm not a nutritionist, but I do talk a lot to nutritionists, both for my own clients, but also for these stories that I do. And it really is something that they all emphasize is whenever possible, go for the whole food. So rather than looking for organic, I know that in that story I mentioned gummies, for example, which is really popular with kids and you know, as a lunch snack and that sort of thing. And really what you're getting there is not very much. You're getting not a whole lot of volume, and you're getting a lot of sugar, even though it says organic and all these other things. So, you know, maybe an apple, maybe some fresh fruit would be better.
Let's talk about the exercise end of the equation and how much we should be getting. How much do you recommend? Is it a set amount for every person, or how do you make distinctions from client to client?
So, you know, the government recommendations are 150 minutes a week of exercise at a moderate intensity. So that could be like jogging or probably a little bit more than just walking. But for some people that seems astronomical, and for some people that doesn't seem like much at all. But I think it's important to remember that this does not have to be, you know, 30 minutes a time or 45 minutes a time, but it could be in increments of 10, 15 minutes. And I think if we start thinking in those terms, it's a little bit or a little bit less overwhelming. Personally, I say every day, do something every day.
And as far as variety goes, is that what you're shooting for, variety?
Yeah. So the 150 minutes is all aerobic exercise. So in other words, using big muscle groups that get your heart pumping, but I feel like both from a government standpoint and also a lot of the recommendations that are out there kind of underemphasize the importance of strength training. And as, you know, as we age, that becomes even more important because we lose that first. We lose our strength. We lose our muscle mass first. And, you know, as we're talking about the whole, you know, the weight, the last 5 pounds, one of the things is to increase lean body mass, and that's exactly what we're doing when we're weight training. So I really feel like that's something that is underemphasized and that people need.
How does lean body mass, how does weight training help make your bones stronger?
Oh, yeah. So weight training and anything that is load-bearing, in other mm-hmm. words, so, for example, running is something that builds bone as well. So running or weight training, anything where you're putting, you know, pressure into your spine. So it could be something like Stairmaster. It could be something, but it would not be something like bicycling. So bicycling builds muscle, but it doesn't build bone because there's no impact. So think of it maybe that way. If there's mm-hmm. no impact, you're not going to be bending or increasing bone mass.
And how does that help bone mass, though? How does it translate to healthier bones?
It actually, you know, it's a living tissue, just like anything else in the mm-hmm. body. So we think about strength training and running as, okay, well, this is, you know, good for endurance, it's good for muscle mass, it's good for building muscle, but it is also building bones. So every time I know for seniors, for example, they'll do this thing where because they can't run, joints aren't healthy enough or whatever the issue may be, mm-hmm. they'll actually tap feet. So they'll sit in a chair and tap the feet down, and that pressure into the heel is a way to build bones. So it doesn't have to be super, you know, high intense to build bone.
When do you know when you're old enough that you need to stop with the high impact? How do you know that? You shouldn't wait for an injury necessarily.
Right. And, you know, that's so individual. Like,
yeah.
You know, you see 80-year-old marathon runners
right.
and who can be totally fine. So I think it's really a matter of, you know, what has your lifestyle been like? Have you been an active athlete? Have you had lots of injuries? And so it has to do with joint health more than anything else. And so if you start feeling any kind of indication, I did a story on runners and foot health, and it's all about, you know, heeding those early warning signs, like, you know, not dismissing discomfort in your knees or dismissing comfort in your lower back, but, you know, going to your trainer or your healthcare provider and asking, you know, is this something to be concerned about?
And the younger you take care of it, the better?
Yes, yes, for sure. And the same thing with all these, you know, all these indicators. I just did this course on seniors, and senior fitness, and some of these things, like, you know, lean body mass, like bone loss, like all these things, can they don't get reversed by starting them, but they slow down. So in other words, you can slow down the aging of all these aspects by a decade or more if you keep at it. So never too early to start.
And never too late.
Exactly, never too late.
How does exercise promote heart health? Is it just like another muscle?
In many ways, that's how we're taught about it, is that it's not just the fact that it helps all these ancillary things that have to do with the heart, like, mm-hmm. You know, diabetes and weight and all that, but it actually strengthens the heart itself and makes it more dynamic, if you will, so that if you're looking at the whole vascular system, it keeps the vascular system elastic and allows that flushing, the blood flushing more easily. So thinking of it as, you know, if the arteries and blood vessels are these tubes inside the body, if they're clogged, then, you know, it's going to be harder to push the blood through. So the exercise actually keeps those more mobile, more elastic.
Let's talk about eating in terms of exercise. So I knew somebody who before boot camp said she always had to have a bowl of a little bowl of cereal or something before she went and worked mm-hmm. out in the morning. Whereas I was the type that, no, I don't eat until after I work out mm-hmm. and try to not do too much with the carbs. Is mm-hmm. everybody different in that respect, or is there any recommendations you give to your clients that along those lines?
Well, I think your friend is right. I'm sorry to say, but I think she's right.
Rats.
Because you really want, you know, it's all about your blood glucose level when you're exercising. So, you know, carbs have such a bad rap right now, and I feel like it's a shame because. Especially if you're involved in the endurance side of things, you need that blood glucose to keep you fresh. You know, if you're going for a long run or a long bicycle ride and you don't have that, that's where you're going to hit the wall. You're going to feel like I can't. Water is not enough. I need some quick sugar. And that's when if you haven't had something before, like a banana or toast or something mm-hmm. before your ride or run, it may feel like it's too late. You can certainly go with a quick carb like gummies or, you know, Gatorade or something like that. But at some point, you're going to benefit from having had a little bit more before the exercise. And I know that's really hard, especially for people who exercise at like 5 a.m.
right.
to try to have something. But I usually do because I have to do my workouts before clients. So I'm up at, you know, 4:30 a.m. So what I'll do is I'll have some applesauce. I might, if I'm going for a longer run, I might do like applesauce and some protein, some sort of protein in there. But keep it small, but just something.
If let's talk about time of workout. A lot of people, it's just a matter of, like you have to fit it in, you know, to fit your schedule, your work schedule. That's pretty typical of most people. But what are our bodies telling us about optimum times for working out?
For many people, it's in the morning. But again, it has to do with when can you actually do it. I find that if it were up to me and if I could choose any time, probably mid-morning, you know, I've been able to have a good breakfast as opposed to just that little tiny something. Mm-hmm. And I'm awake. I'm truly awake for the workout. So probably, you know, if you were to ask people, ideally, probably somewhere between 9 and noon. But obviously, that's when most people work. So that's not gonna happen. So, you know, the typical person is somewhere between 6 and 7 a.m. and then, again, at the same spot in the evening, probably 6 to 7. And also, I think we haven't talked about this so far, but when it comes to all types of fitness, whether you're talking about, okay, I want to lose the weight or, you know, I want to prepare for this race, whatever mm-hmm. it is, you know, sleep is crucial. And getting the 7 to 9 hours is going to be really decide how that workout's going to feel.
Yeah, I saw the 7 to 9 hour recommendation. I went, mm-hmm. you know, if I could, like, if I could get that much sleep, I don't even know what it would. That sleep's a big issue for a lot of people.
Yeah, Yeah, it really is. It really is. And I think that this is such an interesting part of research right now is what exactly does sleep do? And one thing that we do know is that sleep really affects how the whenever you use a muscle, it actually tears the muscle fibers, and that's how you build. That's how you build new muscle. And so when you're resting, that's when it repairs itself. And sleep is the best place for it to really repair because you're not doing anything. And, you know, yes, you're turning, but, you know, for the most part, you're not moving. So this is really important. But again, many of us don't get quite enough.
So let's talk about the tearing and replacing thing. Mm-hmm. It tears the muscle fibers.
Mm-hmm.
To what end? Then what happens?
And then they rebuild. And when they rebuild, the idea is then that they rebuild stronger. And, you know, when you feel, you'll feel this sometimes when you've worked out really hard and you get that delayed soreness in your muscles.
Oh, yes, we all know that.
Yeah, so, you know, and that is actually an important thing to think about. That's all right if it goes away after a couple of days. You don't want to have something that actually continues because that could be a sign of something, you know, too much. You really did too much. But other than that, you're looking at that's when you need to rest to get that recovery, to get that repair of the muscles so that they will get stronger. But yeah, so and that also speaks to your question about how do you decide when to do strength and when to do cardio and what should the combinations be? That's a way to say, okay, well, I'm going to be working, you know, upper body strength today. Well, that means that tomorrow I'm going to take a rest from that, and maybe that's when I get my next 30 minutes of cardio, so that you're mixing it up to give your body a chance to recover.
So let's say you're working out and you're doing a good job with that, but now you have a sleep problem. Now you're not getting as much sleep as you used to. Is there will that affect the lack of sleep affect the effectiveness of your workout because you're not those muscles aren't having as much time to repair?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, so the question too was, you know, eating before working out, sleeping before working out. So, for example, if you say, okay, well, my workouts are so important to me, I'm just going to sleep 5 hours tonight and I'm not going to have breakfast because I won't have time, then what you're actually doing in that workout is going to be much less productive than if you had gotten your sleep and if you'd had your food. So again, when people think about that, you know, I need to create a calorie deficit, the calorie deficit should not happen before your workout. It should happen later on when, you know, the whole idea of like you're fueling for the training you're going to do. Mm-hmm. So fuel during the day and diet at night. Don't eat at night. Diet at night, fuel during the day.
And after a workout, if you know, you are doing that really early morning thing, so you have a banana when you go there, but when you get done, is it time for a regular breakfast or?
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. So basically, I heard this one nutritionist talk about, look at it instead of seeing it as one breakfast, one lunch, one dinner, look at it as food buckets. Like, so you have your breakfast food bucket, you have a little bit before, and then you continue and finish that breakfast bucket, you know, when you come home from your workout or, you know, on your way to work or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And same thing for lunch. So maybe you eat a little bit of it at 11 and then you maybe eat a little bit more of it at 2, because then you come into that whole thing of snacking. Instead of thinking of snacking as being a treat, it's simply just part of your lunch.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us, Gabriela Boston. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
We'll have links to Gabriela Boston's articles. She's a freelance fitness writer and also a fitness trainer. Thanks for listening today on Wellness Wednesday. The producer is Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovitz, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants from Kiram Shaban, Jolie Friedman, and Muyao Shen, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Aber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is a composer of our theme music. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.